Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Michael Caron, Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, who examines the consequences of not having a nationally coordinated coronavirus testing program and the danger of relaxing lockdown restrictions too soon. Asim Mehta of the Worker and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale University, who discusses the strategy behind a class action lawsuit that seeks to free immigrant inmates at risk of contracting the coronavirus from a Massachusetts prison. And Alexandra Bradbury, editor and co-director of Labor Notes magazine, who assesses what the future may hold for workers and labor unions in the post-COVID-19 world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Days after wildfires burned their way toward the shuttered Chernobyl nuclear power complex, dangerous smog filled the air of Kyiv, Ukraine's capital city. According to Swiss monitor IQ Air, Kyiv had the highest level of air contamination of major world cities in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, ahead of the Chinese cities Hangzhou, Chongqing, and Shanghai. Residents of Greater Kyiv were warned to keep their windows closed. In 1986, nuclear fuel in Chernobyl's Unit 4 exploded and burned, spreading radiation across Europe. Today, visible pollution in Kyiv is responsible for multiple negative health effects, including headaches, breathing difficulties, eye irritation, and inflammation of the nose and larynx. Early reports of the wildfires, which started on April 4th, indicated there were radiation hotspots in areas where the fires burned, but Ukraine officials stated there was no radiation risk in areas in the exclusion zone that surround the entombed Chernobyl complex. According to activists, the wildfires had spread to just over a mile from the defunct Chernobyl power plant and a radioactive waste disposal site. The Russian Office of Greenpeace told Reuters that the fires were larger than Ukraine's official estimates and could pose a health risk. After weeks of disputes inside Brazil's government over social distancing policies to contain the spread of the COVID-19 virus, Brazil's right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro fired his popular health minister, Luiz Henrique Mandetta. The firing caused a major uproar, with protesters taking to the streets of many cities, banging pots and pans. With 2,000 acknowledged deaths from the coronavirus, Brazil now braces for new cases and rumors that Bolsonaro himself may have contracted the virus. The president was among a group of Brazilian officials who traveled to the United States in early March, 23 of whom have since tested positive for the virus. Bolsonaro has attacked social distancing measures ordered by most governors across Brazil, insisting the virus is only a mild flu and urging people to return to work. The new health minister, Nelson Teich, an oncologist, has called for more testing but dismissed social distancing orders. COVID-19 is not expected to peak in Brazil for several more weeks. Former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the leftist Workers' Party blasted Bolsonaro's handling of the pandemic as reckless and accused the extremist politician of trying to lead society to a slaughterhouse. Lula fears Brazil could see horrific scenes like what has occurred in Ecuador, where over 10,000 people have died in recent weeks as families were forced to abandon dead bodies in the streets as the health system was overwhelmed. Across the country, advocates for immigrants have filed lawsuits to force the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement to release detainees at risk of contracting the coronavirus. In some cases, ICE has released immigrants, but elsewhere, judges have rejected petitions for the release of inmates held in detention centers where there have been outbreaks of the virus. In Florida, advocates with the University of Miami Immigration Law Clinic, Legal Aid of Broward County, and the Southern Poverty Law Center have filed a lawsuit against ICE and U.S. Attorney General William Barr, demanding the release of detainees in three South Florida detention centers, citing health experts who say the practice of cohorting or segregating affected inmates in separate areas is actually spreading the coronavirus like wildfire among detainees and staff. Tensions have boiled over at detention centers in Louisiana and Texas, where immigrant detainees, fearful of the spread of the coronavirus, demanded their release and were pepper sprayed by correction officers at facilities run by the GEO Group, one of the nation's largest private prison companies. In San Diego, immigrant detainees launched a hunger strike at the Otay Mesa Detention Center run by private prison contractor CoreCivic to protest conditions they say risks their safety during the COVID-19 pandemic. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The Trump administration's failed response to the coronavirus pandemic began with a decision to dismantle the National Security Council's pandemic response team in the spring of 2018. The administration's repeated calls to cut the budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other public health agencies set the stage for the president's disorganized and reckless handling of the health crisis. This was made far worse by Trump's repeated dismissal of warnings about the serious threat posed by the coronavirus. As the president now pushes for a quick reopening of the shuttered U.S. economy, governors across the U.S., both Democrats and Republicans, decry the federal government's failure to coordinate distribution of COVID-19 testing. Public health experts maintain that the country can only phase out lockdown restrictions with widespread testing. While the U.S. is currently processing only 150,000 tests per day, Harvard researchers estimate that the country will have to conduct more than 500,000 tests per day to reopen the nation in the months ahead. With criticism of the president's handling of the crisis rising and his poll numbers plummeting, Mr. Trump has resorted to blame shifting. His public denunciations of China and the World Health Organization and his tweet that he'll suspend all immigration to the U.S. are clearly designed to distract the nation from his costly failure of leadership. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Michael Carome, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, who examines the consequences of not having a nationally coordinated testing program and the danger of relaxing lockdown restrictions too soon.
If we're going to safely resume business in this country to get our economy up and running again, the only way to do that safely and actually to do it effectively is to be able to identify everyone who has symptoms consistent with the coronavirus. And that's a lot of people. And so all those people we need to test for whether or not they have active viral infection with the coronavirus. And that requires a massive effort funded by the federal government, coordinated by the federal government, to distribute the tests, presumably through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and then to monitor all of those results. And anytime someone tests positive, then we need a system of tracing those contacts to identify every person who had contact with an infected person, either shortly before they were symptomatic or while they were symptomatic. And those people need to be tracked down, isolated for at least 14 days and preferably tested to see if they're infected. And that's the only way. That type of massive program for testing and identifying symptomatic and asymptomatic cases and tracing all of their contacts and isolating those contacts, that's the only way we're going to be able to safely resume business as usual in this country.
Dr. Carome, what's the danger of opening business as usual here in this country too soon? We have several states now that are moving to reopen beaches, some businesses, and of course, President Trump is a cheerleader for opening the country as soon as possible, even against the advice of public health experts. There's a concern, I know, that the virus could rebound with a new deadly spike. What's your read on the reopening scenario that both the White House has rolled out in the various states?
Yeah, you know, I think it's absurd to even think about reopening businesses, including they're talking about, you know, very large venues like sports arenas and movie theaters and restaurants. or allowing non-essential travel in the absence of the type of robust federal testing and tracing program that we just talked about. And so, you know, consistent with the administration's, you know, disastrous and chaotic response to the pandemic, you know, starting in January, you know, the plan they put out last week is a recipe for many more preventable deaths and spikes in illnesses and further suffering. And that's what's going to happen if we open up the economy too quickly. And Trump's obviously very motivated to do that. He sees that the economic damage that the pandemic has rendered, and part of that damage has been because of the inability of his administration to have an effective response early on. You know, he's desperate to see the reversal in that so that he can get reelected. That's his sole interest. It's clear from the propaganda briefings he gives every night. So by sending a green light, basically, to states to begin reopening businesses and by encouraging demonstrators in certain states to, you know, to seek liberation from the social distancing guidelines that his own administration put out, you know, he has all but guaranteed that we're going to see spikes in illnesses across the country. More Americans are going to get infected more than that otherwise would. More are going to die. And that itself is going to render more economic damage and delay the recovery ultimately. So he's going to lose on both counts.
In recent days, we've seen President Trump and his administration move to blame shifting, both towards the World Health Organization, China, and Democratic governors. Tell us a little bit about the validity of some of these criticisms that Trump has leveled at China and the World Health Organization and the handling of the pandemic by some of his opponents among Democratic governors.
So when I hear the various criticisms he lays out against China and WHO, it's like he's projecting his own failures onto them. I mean, just about everything he said about China and WHO, like downplaying the pandemic, well, those are exactly the things that Trump did early on in January. In fact, he praised China for its response early on. And when he talks about, you know, a lack of transparency about what's going on in China, well, he is, through his various briefings, shown disinformation and lies about the state of the pandemic in this country. And those are just two examples of where, you know, he's guilty of the same things he's alleging, you know, China and the WHO did. This virus does not distinguish between countries and organizations. You know, every human being in the world is susceptible to this illness because we've never been exposed to it before and have no immunity to it. And at this point, regardless of what China could have done better or what the WHO could have done better, we're now faced with a circumstance in which the most cases anywhere are now in the United States. A person in the United States who's going to get infected, they're going to get it from one of their neighbors or friends or coworkers, not from someone in China at this point. So leveling these types of charges is just not helpful to the type of coordinated international response we need to bring this pandemic under control.
That was Dr. Michael Carome, Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. Find more analysis and commentary on the state and federal response to the coronavirus pandemic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The outbreak of the coronavirus in an Ohio prison is thus far the most serious hotspot in the U.S., surpassing the numbers of those infected at a meat packing plant in South Dakota. There have been many smaller outbreaks at other prisons and in immigration detention centers across the U.S. Those incarcerated, their families, immigrants' rights groups, and legal advocacy organizations around the country have demanded the release of those who can't practice social distancing or the preventative hygiene required to control the spread of the COVID-19 virus. The conditions in which more than 2 million prisoners across the U.S. are held also affect employees inside these facilities, including medical staff and corrections officers. On March 27th, the workers in Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale University Law School and Lawyers for Civil Rights filed a class action lawsuit calling for the release of all immigrants held at the Bristol County House of Corrections in eastern Massachusetts. This was the first legal action of its kind, as other lawsuits have focused on releasing specific individuals or specific groups of at-risk inmates. The Bristol County Prison houses sentenced individuals, those held in pretrial detention, and immigrants being held on civil violations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Asim Mehta, a third-year student at Yale Law School and an intern with the Workers and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic, who discusses the strategy behind the lawsuit.
This lawsuit was the first lawsuit filed on behalf of all individuals in an immigration detention facility seeking release in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The strategy of this lawsuit really reflects the organizing that was done and continues to be done by the folks on the inside. So this lawsuit is specifically targeted at the Bristol County House of Correction, which is the largest immigration detention facility in Massachusetts and houses almost all of the individuals who are residents of Connecticut who are detained by ICE, because there are no ICE detention facilities in Connecticut itself. Folks who reside in New Haven or Connecticut and the surrounding New England states are more often than not brought to the Bristol County Correction Facility. Bristol is notoriously one of the worst facilities in New England in terms of its conditions of confinement, the treatment and quality of care that individuals are subjected to, and that has only been heightened in the COVID-19 crisis. Back in early March, Bristol County was doing absolutely nothing to protect the folks in its custody. In response, the folks in immigration detention organized and released a series of letters describing the conditions of their confinement, the lack of care, and the lack of protections that were provided to them, the approach of the staff at the facility to essentially deny that COVID-19 posed a risk to anyone, and their refusal to provide information to folks who were detained about what the disease entailed and what procedures would be required to mitigate against those. Those letters were released in sequence in the first few weeks of March and published by local news outlets. And a lot of that work to get the word out and keep families of folks who are on the inside informed of what was happening was also cultivated by community organizations in Boston and Connecticut, including the Connecticut Bail Fund and Immigrant Bail Fund, as well as Unidad Latina en Acción, ULA, in New Haven, and a Boston-based immigrant rights group called Beyond, the Boston Immigrant Justice Accompaniment Network.
Asim Mehta, the law clinic at Yale, is co-counsel on this class action lawsuit filed on March 27th for immediate relief on behalf of all the detainees based on the unconstitutional conditions and the risk to their health. I understand the judge is reviewing each case individually, and you've gotten some good results so far.
Yeah, that's right. Within a week, there had been three hearings before Judge William Young to understand the scope of the situation. And as Judge Young wrote in his opinions, he recognized that this is an unprecedented moment requiring direct action and immediate action. The judge certified the class, recognizing that all individuals in the facility were at risk, and that's being 147 people, and noted that all of those individuals were entitled to a review of whether they could be released. He set up a system in which he would review the cases of 10 individuals at a time each day and look at the individual facts of their circumstances and then order their release if it was appropriate. So to date, 46 people have been released from the facility through this litigation, which has reduced the population by almost 40%. The court has continued to review cases every day. We, as counsel for everyone on the inside, have filed individual applications and briefing for the 10 people that he'll be considering and have done so every day for the past 2 weeks now. The court has taken a number of those cases under advisement, essentially saying that it is under consideration and has not issued a ruling one way or another as to whether the court will deny their release or grant it. So there are a number of applications that are currently pending before the court.
It's interesting that the judge is a Reagan appointee.
This is not an issue of politics. This is really an issue of public health and safety and our just minimal commitments to one another to take care of each other. And the court has recognized that this is an urgent, unprecedented public health crisis and that folks who are locked up in jail, forcibly confined, are those who are most at risk. And we are hopeful that the lives of our clients will continue to be taken seriously and protected.
That was Asim Mehta, a student at Yale Law School, and an intern with the Workers and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic. For more information on the lawsuit to free at-risk immigrants from the Bristol County House of Correction in Massachusetts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the country looks toward the post-pandemic future, it's clear that the economic devastation wrought by the coronavirus will be one of the most difficult challenges to overcome, second only to the deadly public health crisis itself. Businesses large and small will struggle to survive in the months ahead, with literally millions of unemployed workers unsure if they'll be able to return to their former jobs. Given that it may take months or years for the economy to rebound, workers across the U.S. will likely face massive layoffs and calls by employers for wage and salary reductions. Public employees will confront major cutbacks in state budgets, where historic losses in revenue will prompt many politicians to demand harsh austerity measures. Frontline healthcare, food production, transit, and delivery workers, who just months ago were dismissed by conservative politicians and commentators as disposable and undeserving of a living wage, are now celebrated as essential to our economy and recognized as heroes. Your reporter spoke with Alexandra Bradbury, editor and co-director of Labor Notes magazine, who assesses what the future may hold for workers and labor unions in the post-coronavirus economy.
Yes, there's just a real bubbling over of protest and frustration among workers in many sectors, both public and private sector, both workers who are in designated essential jobs and are continuing to work under very difficult and dangerous conditions, and workers who felt that their work was not essential and pushed to shut it down. So, for instance, in the auto plants, there were some weeks when the virus was beginning to spread and workers were saying we should shut this plant down. There's no way to socially distance. It's not safe. And management was trying to squeeze some more profit out of them. And so there were walkouts in the auto plants that helped bring those to a close. Also in Detroit, the bus drivers early in the crisis had a wildcat strike and stopped driving the buses out of concern for their safety, and had a set of demands of what they felt would be needed to make the buses safe. And they won them all. The city needed them. They soon were back to work with improved conditions for their own safety. For instance, they're not collecting bus fares anymore, which is means the bus driver has to be in less contact with passengers. It's safer for both parties. It's also obviously a good idea, a popular demand. Transit shouldn't be funded by fares anyway. It ought to be funded by taxes. So that's the kind of improvement that I hope we can keep after the crisis is over. But certainly we've seen lots of walkouts and protests by nurses and healthcare workers demanding access to masks and gowns, demanding better pay in a number of sectors. Workers are some common themes, right, are access to the protective gear people need to do the job safely, better leave provisions. I know I've talked to a lot of postal workers and UPS delivery workers who are concerned about those things, about what about people who have somebody vulnerable at home and don't want to be exposed, so what kinds of provisions for leave are available. Here in New York, the teachers organized, they were on the verge of a sick out. They had organized a sick out when they finally got the mayor to shut the schools. And the schools here in New York should have been shut weeks earlier than they were. And the mayor was dragging his heels and hemming and hawing. And it was teachers who organized and planned the sick out who got those brought to a halt. And teachers organized in a number of places around the country to do that as well. Amazon, Instacart, there are many sectors, of course, where workers are seeing mass layoffs, furloughs, but delivery workers are suddenly in more demand than ever, as many people are stuck at home and doing all of their shopping online, all of their wanting their groceries delivered online. And so that has created certainly additional leverage for those workers to say, well, wait a minute, we need safer conditions, we need a decent right of pay, we need the right to leave.
Alexandra, In your article, you talk about the dangers for workers in this coronavirus economic collapse, but also the opportunities. Certainly one of the big dangers that lay ahead, and we've been told by many economists that this is the single worst economic collapse that this country has witnessed since the Great Depression, in terms of the numbers of people out of work, in terms of the loss of income for millions of people across the country. And it's obviously not isolated to the U.S. It's across the globe. Certainly layoffs and the prospect of losing one's job permanently because of this severe contraction of the economy is one huge fear that many people have at this moment, whether or not the economy rebounds in any rapid succession.
Yes, certainly. That's probably the biggest threat to the labor movement and to workers in general, that millions of people will lose their jobs and never get them back. And we've seen in past recessions that even for the workers who keep their jobs, there can be a very chilling effect as employers, you know, take advantage of the moment to demand concessions, to say we should make do with less. We can, you know, you're lucky to just have a job. Workers, rank and filers, will have to fight many union leaders' instinct to offer up those concessions in the hopes of, you know, keeping something by keeping your head down. We saw that in the last recession. We see that every time, and it doesn't work. We won't be making sacrifices now. This is a time for labor to fight, not to roll over and play dead. And it is there's no reason why we can't make bolder demands. There are parts of the recession that are human produced, right? Like we could counter that with a robust federal program of creating jobs, doing the work that needs doing, and finding the money from the corporations that are getting away without taxes. Like, the austerity is not inevitable, but it will feel inevitable, and we have to mount a determined resistance against that.
That was Alexandra Bradbury, editor and co-director of Labor Notes magazine. Find a link to her recent article titled "Threats and Opportunities: What's the Post-Crisis Forecast for Workers and Related Analysis?" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, Res Radio in Pala, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.